KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I don't think that anyone expects that even with tariffs, there is much prospect of those industries coming back.
10% tariffs take effect today. What it means for Americans. For Saturday, April 5th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid. Thousands of people take to the streets in the first big public opposition to President Trump's second term. Plus, the president has repeatedly vowed to end the war in Ukraine. We take a look at the politics of shifting public opinion.
The majority still want to support Ukraine, but it has slipped.
And a conversation with the celebrity chef Asma Khan, who didn't learn to cook till she was an adult.
Even though I'd never physically cooked, I grew up in the kitchen, watching my grandmother and my mother cooking.
She's got a new Indian cookbook, but first the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Countries around the world are reeling from President Trump's imposition of 10% tariffs on goods from most countries that took effect today. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is heading to Washington next week to meet with Trump to try to get the Israeli tariffs reversed. NPR's Daniel Estrin has more.
A lawyer for Netanyahu says President Trump invited the Israeli leader to the White House this coming Monday, the first world leader scheduled to meet Trump since the U.S. imposed tariffs on many countries. Netanyahu wants Trump to reverse the new 17% tariff on Israeli imports. Netanyahu is currently in Hungary. When he arrived this week, Hungary withdrew from the International Criminal Court. The court has an arrest warrant out for Netanyahu for alleged crimes in the Gaza war. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The Republican-led Senate approved a blueprint for trillions of dollars in spending for tax, defense, and immigration policy. NPR's Claudia Grisales reports the House takes it up next, but there are political hurdles.
Congressional Republicans are racing to enact key elements of President Trump's domestic policy. But Senate and House lawmakers already face some major divides on what that final multi-trillion dollar measure should look like. It reimagines defense, energy, immigration, and tax policy spending, including plans to extend tax cuts passed during Trump's first term, and lifting the U.S. debt limit by $5 trillion to avert a potential breach this summer. But House Republican fiscal hawks say the Senate blueprint does not reduce enough of the federal deficit, with some saying it's time to cut into Medicaid. Claudia Grisales, NPR News.
Severe weather didn't stop thousands of Tennesseans from attending a hands-off protest of the Trump administration's policies in Nashville today. From member station WPLN, Justin Barney reports similar protests took place around the country.
Lanny Glipp is one of several veterans who braved the rain to attend the rally in Nashville. He said he's worried about Social Security benefits and veterans' health care. The Trump administration set its sights on altering the Social Security Administration and the Department of Veterans Affairs.
A lot of veterans are going to be facing catastrophic living situations, and I don't think they've thought this through, you know? It could get really, really bad.
Protesters also decried Elon Musk's role in the Trump administration and his Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, effort in chants as they headed to the state capitol. For NPR News, I'm Justin Barney in Nashville.
Protests also took place across Europe, including London, Paris, and Berlin, where protesters gathered outside a Tesla showroom today. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Ukraine's President Zelensky met with the chiefs of defense for Britain and France in Kyiv today, talking about the potential deployment of a multinational peacekeeping force to Ukraine. The death toll from a Russian missile strike in central Ukraine yesterday has risen to at least 18, including 9 children. Dozens of others were injured. The Russian Defense Ministry claims it carried out a high-precision missile strike on a military meeting. Advocates for wastewater recycling say the technology could make a dent in water shortages across the western U.S., but some states are lagging behind. From member station KUNC, Alex Hager has more.
Wastewater recycling can safely turn sewage back into drinking water. Arizona recycles more than half of its water, and Nevada recycles 85%. Bronson Mack is a spokesman for that state's largest water agency.
That gives our community not just a reliable water source, but helping to stretch and extend that water supply to meet water demands today and meet water demands tomorrow.
A study released this week by UCLA says that technology could be a big help for other states connected to the Colorado River system. Colorado, Wyoming, and Utah all recycle less than 4% of their water. For NPR News, I'm Alex Hager in Fort Collins, Colorado.
In NCAA college basketball, the men's Final Four is taking place today. Right now, Florida is playing Auburn. The score at last check, 60-58 Florida. Later, Houston plays Duke. The winners of the two games head to the championship game on Monday. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid, filling in for Scott Detrow. Starting today, Americans are paying a 10% tariff on nearly everything we import. The Trump administration's announcement of reciprocal tariffs sent the stock market into a tailspin this week. And it raises serious questions for American manufacturers like Dan Digri. He's the CEO of MISCO, Minneapolis Speaker Company. They've been manufacturing speakers in the United States since the late 1940s. And I met him a couple years ago on a reporting trip to Minnesota. I called him back this week.
We're fully committed to manufacturing in the U.S., but now we're stuck with the challenge of having high-cost components.
He told me he had to adapt his business when President Trump first imposed tariffs on China back in 2018. But the new wide-ranging tariffs make it even harder to figure out a supply chain.
Back then it was clear, find other places besides China. Now, where do you go?
Digri is now looking at higher prices for the components that go into his speakers, no matter where he gets them from. And ultimately, he says those costs will likely affect prices for their final product.
These tariffs are taxes on American businesses that get passed on to, you know, ultimately American consumers.
Tariffs are all part of President Trump's plan to divorce the United States from the global economy and return to a system of self-reliance. Take a listen to the president in his own words earlier this week at the White House.
From 1789 to 1913, we were a tariff-backed nation, and the United States was proportionately the wealthiest it has ever been.
Though some people might be feeling a little less wealthy this week after the stock market's plunge. To make sense of it all, we are joined now by NPR's chief economics correspondent, Scott Horsley. Great to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Asma.
So let's begin with a very basic question here, but I think it's important. What is the president hoping to accomplish?
For decades, Trump has nursed this grievance that other countries are taking advantage of the U.S., and he has a kind of steam-driven nostalgia for the Gilded Age, when the U.S. was less globally connected. You heard him talk about that period before 1913. Why that year? Mm-hmm. Well, that's when the U.S. adopted the income tax.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Trump wants to cut the income tax and replace some of that revenue with his new tariffs. That would be good for wealthy Americans who would get most of the benefit of the tax cut, but it's not so good for lower-income families who will have to pay more for imported food and clothes and other necessities.
So the president also says his tariffs will encourage more domestic manufacturing. Let's take a listen to him.
If you want your tariff rate to be zero, then you build your product right here in America, because there is no tariff if you build your plant, your product in America.
So, Scott, what do you make of the president's remarks there?
You know, it's possible that Trump's tariffs will push some manufacturers to locate in the U.S., but only if they think those tariffs are going to stick around for a while. And that's not guaranteed. Economist Ernie Tedeschi of the Yale Budget Lab does not think we're going to see a lot more domestic production of low-value goods like clothing or shoes.
I don't think that anyone expects that even with tariffs, there is much prospect of those industries coming back to the United States, because our labor costs in the United States are much more than they are in places like China and Vietnam and Indonesia.
And one reason factories in the U.S. can afford to pay those good wages is they're very productive. I spoke to a candy maker this week who has plants in both Ohio and Juarez, Mexico, and he told me that his U.S. workers crank out three times as many lollipops per hour as the workers south of the border. But because factories here are so efficient, they don't need that many workers. So we're not going back to a period when, you know, a third of the U.S. workforce was in manufacturing, any more than we're going back to a period when 40% of Americans worked on farms. That's just not going to happen.
So speaking of farms and farming, Scott, other countries, it seems, are starting to already retaliate for President Trump's tariffs. What is that going to mean for farmers and other exporters?
It's going to make it harder for them to sell their stuff abroad. When Trump slapped tariffs on China during his first term in office, China stopped buying a lot of soybeans from the U.S. and bought from Brazil instead. In a trade war, there are a lot of losers on all sides. That was the lesson of the 1930s, and you might remember the movie Ferris Bueller's Day Off, when Ben Stein tried to teach that lesson to a bunch of bored high school students.
The Hawley-Smoot Tariff Act, which anyone raised or lowered, raised tariffs in an effort to collect more revenue for the federal government. Did it work? Anyone? It did not work, and the United States sank deeper into the Great Depression.
Fun fact, Asma, Ben Stein's father, Herb Stein, was the top White House economist in the Nixon administration. He's famous for Stein's Law, which says things that can't go on forever usually stop.
All right, well, we will have to stop there. NPR's Scott Horsley is our chief economics correspondent. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Thousands of anti-Trump protesters took to the streets today in cities across the country, including Atlanta, Boston, Cincinnati, and New York. Take a listen to the scene from the nation's capital. NPR's Emily Feng was at the protest in Washington, D.C., and joins us now. Good to have you with us, Emily.
Thanks for having me, Asma.
So what did you hear about why people are protesting?
They're protesting what they say is executive overreach by President Trump and his ally billionaire Elon Musk. Here's a sampling of signs among hundreds that I saw at the mall today in Washington. There was one that said, quote, "You can't spell felon without Elon." Another that said, "Hands off due process." And this pun, "Are you tariff-eyed?" So the top concerns among protesters I saw today, inflation brought on by trade tariffs, the role that Musk has in the current government because he is not an elected official, and also many kinds of worries about the expansion of executive power.
You mentioned the expansion of executive power. Did you hear specific concerns about that from protesters?
Absolutely. Here's Juliana, a federal employee who did not want her full name aired because she's afraid of being fired herself. She was holding a sign that said, quote, "I need to be able to tell my children I did not stay silent."
This time around, I have concerns that I wonder if we will have an election, to be frank.
She specifically fears that Trump may seek a third presidential term, even though this is unconstitutional. This is expressly prohibited by the 22nd Amendment. Another protester I talked to, Austin Shriver, drove in from Virginia nearby, and he and a friend were holding signs saying, "No kings." And he said he was angry about executive orders cracking down on immigration.
If the president can decide that he's going to ignore the courts when they tell him he's doing the wrong thing, then the courts have no power to check the executive.
He's referring to this ongoing legal case where a federal judge says there was a possibility the Trump administration ignored his court order to stop deportation flights to El Salvador last month.
You know, Emily, it seems like the left has been struggling with how to oppose Trump these last couple of months. We haven't seen the large-scale protests that we saw during Trump's first term. Today seems to have been kind of the first public opposition to President Trump's second term. I'm curious what you were tracking outside of Washington.
These protests are happening all over the country. There are about 1,200 of what organizers are calling hands-off mass action protests. You know, sizable demonstrations at state capitals and parks, city halls, et cetera, nationwide.
Have you heard anything from President Trump about the protest today?
He's out playing golf at his club in Florida today and has not given any interviews. But the White House did say in a statement that his position is, quote, clear. He will always protect Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid for eligible beneficiaries, though the statement did not address the protests directly.
NPR's Emily Feng in Washington. Thank you for your reporting.
Thanks, Asma.
We're now in the home stretch of the NCAA basketball finals, and while there has been no real Cinderella story in this year's tournament, there's still a lot of excitement about the championships. The women's final is tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Two iconic teams will face off, the UConn Huskies and the South Carolina Gamecocks. And we have got Nicole Auerbach of NBC Sports here to give us a preview. She's actually in the arena in Tampa, Florida for the games. Welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, Nicole, when we spoke to you last week, I know your bracket for the women's tournament was still intact. I got to begin by asking you, how's it looking now?
It is not looking too great. I think that Juju Watkins, who unfortunately was injured and tore her ACL, I had put too much faith in her to carry the USC here. I think the two winners of the two national semifinal games, which were pretty lopsided here on Friday night, like those were the two best teams. Those were the right teams. They're the iconic coaches. It's the star power. The teams that have really defined women's basketball for a really, really long time. So it definitely feels like we're getting the two right teams in a heavyweight fight.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the two right teams. We're looking at the number one seed South Carolina battling the number two seed UConn. It sounds like you think that this was expected by many folks. Maybe you don't want to go into predictions, but do you have a prediction for tomorrow's game?
Yeah, you know, facing this back to last week and watching UConn in the Sweet 16 and the Elite Eight, they just look like they're going to win it all. They're firing at such a high cylinder. They're so smooth offensively. And then their defense is honestly a bit underrated. But the way that we saw them shut down the number one overall seed in UCLA and the unique challenge of the 6'7" center Lauren Betts, you just can't come away from that and not be impressed by what UConn is doing right now. They also beat South Carolina handily a few months ago. And so I think that they're going to be the ones that are cutting down the net on Sunday.
I do want to ask you about the audience and the viewership in this moment, because I do think there was some concerns that with Caitlin Clark going pro, that maybe the viewership numbers for the NCAA women's basketball tournament would drop. How has this year's tournament compared to last year and 2 years prior?
Well, I think last year was an aberration. I mean, the women's championship game outdrew the men's, which has never happened before. And I don't think anyone thought it was going to match that. But what's really encouraging is the numbers are significantly up compared to 2023, the year before, you know, the peak of the Caitlin Clark effect in women's college basketball. So I think that shows you that people who have been introduced to the sport in recent years are sticking around, even if they are now also watching the WNBA.
Nicole Auerbach of NBC Sports, thank you so much for talking to us. Hope you enjoy the game tomorrow.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. As President Trump's 10% tariffs on goods from most countries in the world take effect today, countries are reeling. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu plans to press Trump at a meeting in D.C. next week to ease up on the ones imposed on Israeli goods. Israel's bombardment of Gaza is also expected to be discussed. The maker of British luxury vehicles, Jaguar Land Rover, says it's pausing shipments to the U.S. this month, just days after Trump's 25% auto tariffs went into effect. And thousands of demonstrators around the country protested Trump and White House advisor Elon Musk's actions. Demonstrations have been organized by more than 150 groups and are taking place in all 50 states. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at cigna.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at WTGrantFDN.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid. President Trump vowed to end the war in Ukraine before he even took office, but that has proven to be harder than he predicted. Ukraine has agreed to the unconditional ceasefire the United States proposed, but Russia has not. As Trump tries, with difficulty, to get a peace deal between Ukraine and Russia, public opinion about the conflict has been shifting. NPR senior national political correspondent Mara Liasson reports.
Public opinion polls show a majority of Americans still favor Ukraine over Russia by big margins. A March Economist YouGov poll showed 60% sympathize with Ukraine, only 3% with Russia. Dina Smeltz is the vice president of public opinion and foreign policy at the Chicago Council of Global Affairs. Her latest poll on support for aid to Ukraine found something similar. But over time, she says, she's noticed some shifts.
A majority still want to support Ukraine, but it has slipped. And the reason it slipped is because the Republicans have tanked. So that's drawing down the overall average.
Republican pollster Bill McInturf says there's a good reason for the softening in Republican support for Ukraine: Donald Trump and Trump's perceived hostility to Ukraine and its leader, Volodymyr Zelensky.
On this and just multiple other issues, the Republican Party is consolidated. They are enormously supportive of President Trump. President Trump has had the capacity to move and shift the Republican Party to support his views.
But there's a big contradiction in the polling. McInturf says in his survey for NBC, Vladimir Putin continues to be one of the most reviled figures in the U.S. Putin's rating is 84% negative and just 3% positive. That means there are lots of Republicans who love Trump and loathe Putin at the same time. And that's despite Trump's insistence that Putin is a trustworthy negotiating partner, even a kind of foxhole buddy.
Let me tell you, Putin went through a hell of a lot with me. He went through a phony witch hunt where they used him and Russia. Russia, Russia, Russia. You ever hear of that deal? That was a phony.
Trump is referring to his long-held grievance about the investigation into Russian election interference in 2016. Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, was just as positive about Putin after meeting with the dictator in Russia. Here's Witkoff on Tucker Carlson's podcast.
I don't regard Putin as a bad guy. That is a complicated situation, that war.
Despite all the praise for Putin from the White House, some Republicans in Congress are still willing to express a different view.
Putin is a murderous KGB thug that murders his political enemies and is a dictator.
Agent, he's not to be trusted, and he is dangerous.
Putin is a war criminal and should be in jail for the rest of his life, if not executed.
That was Oklahoma Republican Senator James Lankford on NBC, and House Speaker Mike Johnson and Senate Armed Services Committee Chair Roger Wicker on CNN. These opinions from Republicans are a rare break with Trump. Right now, there's a widely held view that Trump is eager to force Ukraine, but not Russia, to make concessions. The fear is that Trump will make a peace deal that would allow Russia to rearm and return in a few years' time to subjugate Ukraine. Mark Thiessen, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank, says that analysis is all wrong.
There's a lot of lazy conventional wisdom thinking about Donald Trump that doesn't understand where he is on Ukraine. He doesn't want Ukraine to surrender.
Thiessen says it's more accurate to view Trump's apparent affinity for Putin as a negotiating tactic, and he points to the U.S. proposal to develop Ukraine's mineral resources.
Look, the fact that he's engaged in this minerals deal and an infrastructure deal is an investment in a sovereign and free Ukraine, and he has an incentive to create a peace deal that will protect that sovereignty and independence because he's going to invest a lot of money in Ukraine. He's not going to pour that all into a country that he thinks is going to get conquered.
Ukraine, Russia, the United States, and yes, even Europe will all have some kind of say in a peace deal, if there is one, and so may public opinion. According to Bill McInturff, this could be one of the rare times that Americans' opinions about foreign policy matter politically.
I've spent a long time in my career saying foreign policy matters when American lives are lost or we're in combat.
But McInturff says the Ukraine-Russia war may have changed that paradigm because there's been so much engagement and interest in this issue. That means Trump has to decide how much he wants to negotiate a deal between Russia and Ukraine that is broadly acceptable at home. Right now, the Republican base is devoted to Trump, but also overwhelmingly negative about Putin. That's a factor Trump may have to take into account as he tries to end a war he says should never have started. Mara Liasson, NPR News.
You're walking down a city street, you turn a corner, and you're swarmed by zombies. You fight them off with a folding chair. Explosions rattle the street around you.
You're basically beating up enemies in a dystopian version of New York City. And there's all this kind of like ooze spilling out of this onto the street.
That's Vincent Accavino, All Things Considered producer who covers video games for the show. This game is called Beatdown City Survivors, and it'll be released later this year.
So it's like a really old school looking game. It's all like pixel art that's reminiscent of retro kind of video games and arcade games.
The game might look retro, but it says a lot about this current moment in video game development. The video game industry is massive, probably way bigger than most people think. It brought in around $187 billion in revenue last year, which is more than the film and music industries combined. Much of that money was made by big developers creating big games, but more and more small independent studios are disrupting the space. Studios like New Challenger, which is making Beatdown City Survivors.
Some of the biggest hits in the industry are coming from developers that are, you know, a team of one person. It kind of goes to show the power dynamics right now in the industry, where small independent developers do have the power and potential to make big video games without the risk that comes with making a giant multi-million dollar project as a big studio.
Today, for our weekly Reporter's Notebook segment, Vincent takes us inside this evolving world and tells us how he thinks about it and how he covers it. That includes a recent reporting trip to the Game Developers Conference in San Francisco. It's an industry trying to navigate a whole host of issues, massive layoffs, the advent of AI, games that take years to be released, and that schism between big and small developers. All Things Considered co-host Scott Detrow picks up the conversation, asking what games like Beatdown City Survivors tell us about this current moment.
Why is this the game that you flagged that you wanted to start this conversation talking about?
So I find the creator of this game and his story, his name is Sean Alexander Allen, absolutely fascinating. Years ago, he worked for a major video game company. So he was on the other side of the industry, big budget games. Now he's making his own games. And he sees the industry right now at a crossroads. He looks around and says, why are we seeing so much volatility in this industry? Why are we seeing the mass layoffs that we're seeing? Right now, it takes an incredibly long time for big budget games to be released.
Yeah.
Games people are waiting for a long time for. He worked for Rockstar 13 years ago. Rockstar Games is the creator of Grand Theft Auto. It's been that same amount of time since a Grand Theft Auto game came out.
It's been that long?
Yeah.
So there's been more than a decade of this most recent one being. Is that just because it's so ambitious or because it's ballooned or what's the clear answer?
Well, that is kind of the question. If you ask someone like him, he says it's a combination of these ballooning budgets and also bad management strategies and everyone just needing it to be a $1 billion game. He says, why not make 10 games in the span of like however many years it takes to make one large giant game.
Like, we're all taught not to put all your eggs in one basket. I don't know, you look at indie games and we're putting out a lot of good stuff. And it's like, you can make 10 games in the span that you make these one game. Why don't you make 10 games and make different games? It's boring.
So you've got all of these people like that creating these really interesting games, but at the same time, you have a handful of massive companies spending, what, like hundreds of millions of dollars developing the Big Ten games?
Yeah, so video game budgets are kind of like this closely guarded secret, but we know that, for example, The Last of Us Part 2, Last of Us has been adapted to like an HBO series, so yeah. A lot of people are now familiar with that game. The second game in the series cost around $200 million to make. And that's fine.
It's like movie-level budgets.
Oh, beyond.
Yeah.
Beyond. Because these people have often literally thousands of people who work on them. That's fine if your game makes $500 million in return, but it doesn't always do that. And that's where the problems start. Like, for example, last year there was a game that came out called Concord. And that game had a big budget, a lot of expectation, and it absolutely flopped. And in 1 month, they shut that game down. A multi-hundred million dollar project, most likely.
They just shut it down. If you bought it, you can't play it.
They refunded it.
This is all interactive online playing mostly now. It's not like you, to go back to that 16-bit era, you get the cartridge, you put it in, you've got the game forever.
Exactly. And I think also because these games require constant development, if the projects shrink in size or if they're not successful, then they have to let people go.
I think that all gets to AI in this industry. What's the best way to frame how developers are using AI right now? And I imagine it's two very different answers when you talk about those two sides of the industry.
So I talked to a lot of developers at the conference as well who have very different opinions about AI. One demo I saw showed off a Call of Duty kind of game, and this was a demo that was given to me by Elvis Liu at Tencent, which is the biggest video game company in the world. They're a Chinese company. And basically, the demo shows you interacting with your squad mates. So you speak to your squad mates, and they will listen to you and interact with the environment in very specific ways. So if you say, like, go behind the red car or the rust-colored car, they'll know exactly what you're talking about, and they'll do it. This is interesting for the player, but Elvis Liu at Tencent says it's also helpful for the development of these video games.
In our case, we have more than 17,000 in-game objects in just one map and numerous locations. So it would be infeasible to use a traditional method to issue a command with all these targets. So voice control or voice command becomes the only efficient way to communicate with an AI.
So that's one example of a thing that kind of made sense to me. Then you hear from independent developers, and they are largely not excited about this. Many of them are kind of skeptical of what it means for their own creativity in this industry. And so, like, when I speak to, like, people in narrative or art departments, they're like, well, this is a part of the job that I like to do. Like, I don't want to automate the part of my job. They're like, maybe if, like, it sent emails for me, but not like if it writes my stories. One person I talked to was Keita Takahashi. He developed a game that people of my age love very much called Katamari Damashi, and it's like this absolutely ridiculous game. It has a great sense of humor. It's basically you're rolling up a bunch of small objects on the world into a giant ball, and then they become planets in the sky.
That sounds relaxing.
Yeah, it's absurd, but on purpose, and it has a great sense of humor. But Takahashi was very blunt about the AI thing, and actually he brought this up unprompted in a different interview I was doing, and here's what he said.
Who care about the AI? I mean, AI is just the business stuff, because they just want to make more money.
So that's an example of someone who is just very purely an artist who is completely not interested in generative AI stuff.
All right, so you're at this massive conference, tens of thousands of people. Two different similar questions.
Yeah.
What are your favorite things about video games right now as somebody who plays them? And what are the most interesting storylines that you're paying attention to as somebody who reports on them?
Yeah, I mean, the conference really hit this home for me. The industry right now is just filled with so many video games that are great, especially because we've had this explosion of smaller teams making games. Like, there are just too many video games to play that are great. So that's like a great problem to have for the industry and for someone like me who like loves playing games. But I think when it comes to the most interesting question facing the video game industry right now, to me, it is the AI question. Because, you know, 5 to 10 years ago, we saw Meta go all in on VR, and everyone was like, oh, maybe this is the next big thing. And it's not.
Yeah.
It's really not. And I think you need broad enthusiasm from both video game players and the industry to be for something like that to really happen. Mm-hmm. And that's, I don't know yet what's going to happen, because it feels like the big tech companies like Nvidia and stuff are pushing it hard and want AI to be the future of games, but I haven't seen the same sort of excitement on the other end.
That's Vincent Accavino, All Things Considered's resident gaming expert. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Medical debt as a whole in the United States amounts to roughly $200 billion, which sounds overwhelming. So today we're taking a practical approach to the topic because there's a well-kept secret about the astronomical dollar amounts you might see on your medical bills.
They're fake numbers. They can be negotiated.
That's Jared Walker, founder of the nonprofit DollarFor. He says these bills also can be inaccurate, and you may not have to pay them at all, depending on your income. LifeKit host Mariel Segura has more.
Walker says when you get a medical bill, the first thing you should do is find out if you qualify for something called charity care. Under federal law, nonprofit hospitals are required to have these policies.
To keep their nonprofit status, they have to provide free or reduced care to patients within a certain income range. Typically, a policy will say something like, if you're at or below, 300% of the federal poverty guideline, then you're eligible for free care or reduced care.
Unfortunately, nothing about this process is straightforward. The income cutoff for charity care can be different depending on the hospital and sometimes the state you're in. Also, your hospital may not volunteer that you're even eligible for charity care. To find out more, do a web search for your hospital name plus the phrase financial assistance and find the application.
Typically, it's like two pages. Who are you? Who do you live with? Where do you work? How much money do you make? And it's like, then prove it. Proof of income, pay stubs, tax return, all that. So you fill all that out and submit it to the hospital through whatever wacky way they do that, typically through fax or mail or whatever. And then you can wait a couple weeks and then just check in as often as you like. I typically bother them a lot about it.
By the way, for-profit hospitals often have these policies as well, though they're not required to by federal law. If you don't qualify for charity care, the next step is to ask the hospital for an itemized bill and take a look at everything on it. Did you actually have that procedure done? Walker says it's common to find errors. You may also find things on your bill that are accurate but seem like an overcharge, like $100 for a couple bandages or aspirin. Take note of those and bring them up to the billing office. Even if your bill is technically correct, you can negotiate. One way to do that, if you have savings and you can afford to pay something up front, call the billing office and ask, what's the settlement amount?
Like, what will you take right now if I can close out this account? Typically, we can get 30 to 50% off just by asking that. If I pay you right now, what can I get lowered off this bill?
If you can't afford this approach, you can still negotiate. Ask what they can do to lower the bill. And you can get on a payment plan. That's typically better than putting the debt on your credit card because often hospitals will not charge interest. Lastly, remember that this is a long game. You may not get anywhere with the first couple calls, but keep plugging away at it or ask a family member or friend to help you follow up. And keep in mind that while medical bills may seem urgent, especially when they say due upon receipt, you have a lot of time before they're sent to collections or they affect your credit.
There's no like sense of urgency. You have to pay this now. You can take a deep breath, get a plan, and go from there.
For NPR News, I'm Mariel Segura.
For more LifeKit, go to npr.org/LifeKit. This is NPR News.
This is Tracy Chapman's goal when she writes a song.
Every song is like a snapshot. 3 to 5 minutes, you have to tell a story or express something completely. Don't you know, talking about a revolution.
Tracy Chapman on her music and Standing the Test of Time. Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Nintendo says it's delaying pre-orders for its Switch 2 gaming device in the U.S., saying it needs to assess the potential impact of President Trump's tariffs. Pre-orders for U.S. customers had been scheduled to start next week. This as the U.S. began collecting Trump's new 10% baseline tariff on all foreign imports today. The United Nations is calling for more support for Myanmar, where the death toll from last week's earthquake has now topped more than 3,300. The top UN aid official made his appeal during a visit today to Mandalay, one of the hardest hit areas. And Southern food is being recognized by one of the biggest names in the international culinary world, Michelin, which says for the first time it will create a new regional guide for the U.S. South. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid. Some states have been loosening the rules around how much teens should be allowed to work on the job. And the Republican-led Florida legislature is debating questions like whether 14-year-olds can have jobs or how late bosses can ask 16-year-olds to work on school nights. In Tallahassee, WFSU's Tristan Wood reports.
One proposal would allow 16-year-olds to work more than the current 30-hour-a-week cap, including longer days and later hours, even on school nights. Another would loosen some limits on 14-year-olds working if they're in homeschool, virtual education, or already graduated. One of the bills is sponsored by Tampa Republican State Senator Jay Collins. He says it is about parental rights and giving children more access to jobs.
I believe that parents are best suited to take care of their kids and manage their schedules and make sure that they're doing what's best for them. I don't understand why the state needs to go beyond the federal regulations in this case.
Federal laws are weaker, but Florida already loosened some child labor laws last year. And the state isn't alone. Nina Mast is a policy and economic analyst at the Washington-based Economic Policy Institute, which seeks to improve wages for working people. She says dozens of states have considered similar bills and several passed some last year.
What we are seeing, especially coming out of the pandemic, is really just a push that is led by the business industry and some right-wing think tanks to be able to make it easier to hire young people at lower wages for longer hours and in more hazardous jobs under the guise of wanting to address a so-called labor shortage.
Mast says the changes are intended to drive down wages that went up in lower-paying industries during the pandemic, meaning jobs like servers in restaurants and delivery drivers.
This is really a concerted nationwide effort to essentially create a permanent underclass of disempowered low-wage workers.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis seemed to back the general idea of more minors in the labor force, speaking recently at an immigration panel that included U.S. immigration czar Tom Homan.
What's wrong with expecting our young people to be working part-time now? I mean, like, that's how it used to be when I was growing up. Why do we say we need to import foreigners, even import them illegally, when teenagers used to work at these resorts?
He He didn't mention child labor laws, but his comments were seized on by Democratic lawmakers who said child labor shouldn't be used to enable an immigration crackdown. John Flitter, a political science professor at Kansas State University, who's written a book on child labor laws, agrees.
Studies show that when kids start working, you know, these hours, they do not do well in school. Some of them drop out, you know. And if you don't have a high school degree, a diploma, you're not really going to be successful financially for the rest of your life.
But State Senator Collins defends his legislation, saying teens working jobs provides other skills they can't get in school.
We want our kids to be academically prepared, but let's talk about soft skills. Let's talk about adult function. Let's talk about executive thought process and management. Where do they learn that? Do we teach them that in school? I think if you go look at what's going on, we really don't. We don't prepare them for executive function. We don't even have home ec and things like that.
It's unclear what will pass Florida's legislature. The Senate president and House speaker both say they are unsure about further reducing child labor protections. But in a committee meeting this week, lawmakers raised the idea of loosening rules for 13-year-olds to work in the summer. For NPR News, I'm Tristan Wood in Tallahassee, Florida.
The remains of one of the last victims of the Pearl Harbor attack have been returned home. A 20-year-old black sailor was buried with military honors this week. WUNC's Jay Price has the story of Neil Fry.
In later wars, there would have been a uniformed notification team to cushion the blow. But it was 1941, so word that the 20-year-old mess attendant was missing and presumed dead simply came by telegram.
The postmaster brought it out and read it to my mom and dad.
The Navy Department deeply regrets to inform you, he began.
That's how they found out.
That's the last of his nine siblings still alive, Mary Ruth Fry McCrimmon, age 87. All the siblings worked on the family farm in North Carolina as children. The fact that Neil Fry's body hadn't been identified became an undercurrent in family history, a stubborn hope that somehow he hadn't died.
My mom used to say she loved people watch. She would go anywhere she could get a chance to go, just watch all the men go by to see if she could see Neil.
McCrimmon was only 3 years old when Neil Fry joined the Navy, following another brother into service.
That time they couldn't get no jobs. They had, well, I'll just go ahead and say racial thing. They didn't get no job. So they went where they could get paid, but that was such a little amount that they got.
At this point, black sailors were only allowed to be mess attendants, essentially doing whatever officers wanted, from cooking their meals to doing their laundry. Historian Glenn Knobloch has written books on the experiences of black sailors in the U.S. Navy.
You could almost think of them as personal servants.
But during battle, the mess attendants had far more important duties. Knobloch said the most typical for black sailors would have been passing ammunition up from deep in the bowels of the ship, which is where Fry's remains were found later when the ship was raised.
There is still this perception that black men only served as waiters and servants to officers. And while that was their primary duty, they also served as fighting men.
Perhaps even as Fry was dying, one of his fellow mess attendants, a burly Texan named Dory Miller, had helped move the ship's dying captain before jumping behind a machine gun and, despite not being allowed to train with the weapon because of his race, blazed away at the attacking aircraft. Miller was awarded the Navy Cross, and his story helped force the Navy to open other jobs to black sailors.
What we've learned, for example, from the case of Dory Miller is that everybody did what they needed to do and what was asked of them.
Forensic anthropologist Laurel Freese leads the Defense Department project identifying remains of troops lost in the attack. Freese's colleagues work on MIA cases from all over the world, but her job feels particularly immediate and personal. The building they work in is on base, little more than a mile from where the West Virginia sank.
So we are surrounded and immersed in this history and reminders of it every day. And we want to make these identifications absolutely as quickly as we can to get these answers back to families who've been waiting, now in the case of our Pearl Harbor losses, for, you know, the better part of a century.
Fry's story has a particular resonance at this moment. Under the Trump administration, the Pentagon has been scrubbing some mentions of black troops from its websites. DOD officials said some images have been removed in error, but the fear remains that the contributions of black service members are being erased. And for Neil Fry's last living sibling, the facts about how he lived and died do matter.
I know my mom and dad. If there's any kind of way they know about this, I know they're some kind of happy.
Some kind of happy. And the Pentagon is one step closer to identifying all the sailors from the USS West Virginia. Just five remain. For NPR News, I'm Jay Price in Durham, North Carolina.
I often think of spring as the season of rebirth and renewal. But for the chef Asma Khan, growing up in India, it was always late summer that replenished the cracked earth and drove down the oppressive heat, because late summer was monsoon season.
But when the rains came, it was as if the earth was blessing you. For me, my father would always tell me that it is about hope and believing that all difficult periods will end.
Asma Khan left India and moved to England with her husband in the early 1990s. And it was only then that she learned to cook. And it was only after she'd gotten a PhD in constitutional law that at the age of 45, she opened Darjeeling Express. That's a London restaurant that has made her into something of a celebrity chef and an authority on Indian food. Asma Khan has a new cookbook titled Monsoon. She walks us through making a proper pot of rice or a basic spice blend, but she also includes recipes for simple midweek meals and date night spreads. She arranges the book by season. And when we spoke, she talked to us about why eating seasonally matters.
30 years ago, when I came to this country, you only got strawberries at a certain time, you got asparagus at a certain time, and now you have things whole year round. And eating seasonal is so important. It's the core of what all our traditional kind of food was, you know, back wherever your heritage is from. You always ate with the season. Festivals were linked to seasonal food and produce, harvest festivals, spring festival. Food for me is deeply spiritual. It's linked to my identity, my ethnicity, who I am. And the things that you cook, it should be what is in season, what is fresh. Not some jet-lagged okra that has been flown across the oceans, wrapped in cling film, refrigerated lorry. Why do you want that carbon footprint on your table?
I want to ask you about some of the specific recipes in your cookbook, because sometimes I will say Indian food in restaurants can seem almost like unapproachably fancy, decorative. And yet you talk about wanting to make this food that, you know, you can cook at a date night at home. So what is your favorite recipe in here that you would say is an easy first step if you are not familiar with cooking Indian food?
The omelet curry.
Okay.
Because everybody can make an omelet, even if it's a bad omelet. The omelet curry, the gravy is just really vibrant and tangy. It's a tomato-based gravy. And it's, you know, unlike if you're intimidated by cooking chicken or, you know, dealing with spices and you don't want all that. That's a great way to start. There is a lovely potato dish with poppy seeds in it. Very easy. And there's a rice with orange and cassia bark, which is like cinnamon. And once you make rice...
Because I have Googled how to make rice. And this is embarrassing because my family is South Asian. But I sit there watching these videos, which should be so basic, I think, to make rice. But I find it rather difficult to make the right rice.
It's not. And the thing is that... So... Because I've gone through this whole journey of not knowing how to cook, then learning how to cook, I understand what is it that I didn't understand. So I think that is, I've used that to my advantage. So I'm teaching you how to cook with your senses the way I learned. And even though, you know, if you're somebody who needs instructions, the instructions are there. But alongside with the instructions is the poetry, is the magic. I'm telling you what's happening in your pan. I'm telling you how things are going to transform, how you kind of make sure that nothing goes wrong. I'm troubleshooting for you. I'm telling you alternatives. Because I understand that, you know, you can't follow a recipe and replicate it completely. Obviously, follow the basics, otherwise you're not going to end up with that dish. But just tweak it, do things that make you comfortable, do things that make you smile, make yourself happy.
You did write that despite your love for the artistry of Indian cooking, much of it is actually quite modular. Can you explain that? What do you mean by that?
Because, first of all, for us, food in the East was medicine, was medicinal. So when you start cooking a dish, the first thing you put in are the spices. These are normally whole spices. They are oil. There are oils in cinnamon. There's oils in clove, in cardamom. They get released into that oil. So you build it up. So you, like an orchestra, each flavor layering is like an instrument. And you're building it up one after the other till it becomes this beautiful melody. And then you come up with this great dish. It's this kind of layering of it. It's step by step. And you will recognize that modular kind of approach to cooking. Once you cook couple of things in the book, you'll see.
So you are not just a cookbook author, of course. You are a chef, and you founded a popular Indian restaurant in London called Darjeeling Express. I want listeners to know that you started that restaurant after your PhD, in your 40s. I cannot imagine making a career change of that sort. Was that scary?
No, it wasn't scary. And for anyone who's listening to this, and you're in your 40s, please believe in yourself first. When you believe in yourself, then you understand your second chance. There's a little voice inside us, a little flickering flame that we ignore because we're trying to, earn enough money to pay the mortgage, doing the things that everyone does. You've got the same kind of car as your neighbor. In this race for life, we ignore that little voice, that flickering flame, that desire to do something else. And I think 40 is really the best age to start. You might have lost loved ones. You've had to leave the city. You've been uprooted for other things. So whatever journey you've been through, you've survived. You're powerful. You're so powerful, you don't recognize it. For a long time, if I was alone, I would open a box of cereal and just eat it without milk. Because I would think, I'm just alone in the house. Why will I cook? I want people to cook for themselves. Slow down for a minute. Embrace yourself. Hug yourself. Feed yourself. Nourish yourself.
Your restaurant is in the Michelin Guide for its version of home-style cooking. It is also famous for having an all-women kitchen staff of all ages. Why did you make that commitment? Why was it so important for you to do that?
Because we have lost out. When you look at around you, not just our cuisine, South Asian cuisine. If you look around everywhere, who are the heroes? They're male chefs. And I wish them all success. But the feminine energy in all our culinary traditions has always been the mother, the grandmother. Somehow it's only good enough if they're cooking for free at home. When I wanted to open a restaurant, women in hospitality told me, you're going to fail. I told them, watch me rise. I'm going to set the world on fire. This drives me. And this is why I'm so grateful that people are supportive, come to my restaurant, whether they're a celebrity or who they are, every person I'm grateful for, because you are allowing us to live our dreams. And hopefully one day I will see someone else opening a restaurant, an all-female restaurant, and I'll watch her rise and I will applaud.
Asma Khan is the chef and founder of Darjeeling Express in London. Her new cookbook is Monsoon. Asma, it has been such a treat speaking with you, and I do hope I can one day travel to your restaurant and enjoy the food in person.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the University at Buffalo, the University at Buffalo is evolving AI technologies with the goal of solving some of society's most pressing challenges. More at buffalo.edu/AI. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.